This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
The Labour lead is still fairly stable at around 20%, and it has been like that for a long time now. So it's not made a sort of catastrophic difference, but it presumably cannot help for this story to be in the press day after day for the Conservatives, because as you say, it does bring back all bad memories about Tory sleaze for them.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast as we enter the final week of the general election campaign. We're devoting this edition to how we think it might shake down in Kent. I'm Simon Finlay, the local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who keeps tabs on Medway.
Hello.
And Daniel Esten, who covers the borough and district councils.
Hello.
We also have KM Group political editor Paul Francis for his take on another interesting week as we inch closer to the big day.
Hello.
And our special guest this week is Martin Baxter, the founder and boss of Pulsar Electoral Calculus, who will be casting his weathered eye across the likely scenarios come July the 4th. First up, we're going to talk to Robert. What's been going on your neck of the woods in this campaign?
So in Medway, the election campaign, like everywhere else, has been rumbling on with the Labour battle bus and deputy leader Angela Rayner visiting Rochester this week. In Gillingham and Raynham, some polling conducted on behalf of The Economist predicted 55% of the vote share would go to Labour and only just 20% for the Tories, a huge swing from 2019.
That's massive, isn't it? So are Labour victories in the three Medway seats almost guaranteed for the Labour Party?
Not necessarily. Chatham and Aylesford is a seat where it's believed the margins will be incredibly close, even looking at like less than a percentage point of difference between first and second place, which is something we're probably going to talk about later. Tactical voting will probably play a really significant role here. In Rochester and Strood, Reform UK are perceived to be doing quite strongly. The seat was held by UKIP following the defection of Mark Reckless in 2014, and he kept it in the subsequent by-election. And the Labour Party have been throwing quite a bit of their campaign against the Reform UK, publicising an employment tribunal case where the candidate Daniel Dabin had to pay a former employee a total of £3,000 because of unpaid wages, holiday pay and some damages. I wouldn't say any of the seats are a foregone conclusion, and it seems like the parties agree with that.
Okay, turning to you, Dan, which hustings have you had the pleasure of attending?
So I've had the pleasure of sampling the vibe at no less than three hustings in the past week. I went to one in Canterbury, one in Margate, and one in Herne Bay for the new Herne Bay and Sandwich constituency.
What were they like? Anything particularly rowdy?
So the Canterbury one was definitely the rowdiest. The other two were pretty subdued and civilised. But in Canterbury, there was quite a lot of heckling and barracking. Rosie Duffield, former MP for Canterbury, currently the candidate, is expected to win again. She wasn't actually in attendance, citing sort of safety and security concerns, but there were evidently a lot of people who went to that hustings mainly with the intention of grilling her on her position on issues of gender identity, which has sort of become her main political issue. There was a lot of heckling on other stuff as well, other than when she slated the Tory government. The Reform candidate, Bridget Porter, didn't seem to endear herself to the audience, and the Tory candidate, Louise Harvey-Quirk, seemed to do basically everything she could to avoid mentioning that she's actually running as a Tory and presumably supported most of the party's policy for a while now.
Mm. So what are the big issues that came up?
Two really big ones which came up a lot were the environment and housing. So Kent's affected quite significantly by sewage discharges and the like, and environmentalists are a disproportionately organised lobby group. But it's obviously an issue of major public concern. It causes real trouble for the Tories, since a lot of straight-up pollution of the waterways by water companies has happened on their watch. Housing as well is obviously a huge issue, and in local councils at least it animates more people than pretty much anything else. Every candidate at every hustings I went to said the same thing to varying degrees. Yeah, we need more social and affordable homes. We want to minimise the amount of beautiful countryside that gets built on and so on. And it's a position designed to appease basically everyone. Though I did notice that Labour candidates are a little bit coy on this issue. The Labour manifesto says not only will they build 300,000 houses a year, 1.5 million over the next parliament, but they'll bring back mandatory housing targets for local councils to make sure that those are hit. And for various obvious reasons, Labour candidates don't want to say outright to attendees at hustings that mass house building is in the national interest and some of it may have to go in places which they don't like.
What were your main takeaways from these gatherings?
So I think it's worth caveating this with the fact that only a sliver of the public choose to spend their evenings attending these sort of things. Not many many people want to attend them, and you know, they're not really a great barometer of public opinion. But it won't surprise you to hear it was not good for the Conservatives, where they turned up. That is Helen Harrison, the Tory candidate for East Thanet, wasn't in attendance at the hustings I went to in Margate, though in fairness to her, she has been to other ones. But that whole event and all the other ones I went to were pretty much non-stop Tory bashing, receiving rapturous applause. In the Margate one, even the Reform candidate who was attacking the Conservatives from the right worked the crowd pretty well by laying into the government. In Herne Bay, Roger Gale, who's been the North Thanet MP since 1983, he wasn't met with hatred, but he wasn't exactly working the crowd either. He seemed pretty resigned to defeat, and he was saying, he's deputy speaker, and he was saying in Parliament, you know, that he wants to help out the new crop of MPs and the new government because he's established a reputation of being fair and impartial. You know, not exactly a strong argument for the kind of policy you'll get under the Conservatives. It's quite defensive. The real fight seemed to be for the anti-Tory vote between the Greens, Liberal Democrats and Labour. You know, especially in Canterbury, what I noticed was that the Greens and Liberal Democrats have positioned themselves pretty explicitly to the left of the Labour Party. And at this point in the campaign, that may worry Labour people much more than it does the Tories.
So what have you been working on, Simon?
Well, Sunday saw the hustings for the Weald of Kent seat at the general election. This is an interesting one because it's a brand new seat composed of parts of four Kent Westminster patches, all held by the Conservatives until Rishi Sunak went to the country in May.
So what's the atmosphere like at these things?
Well, firstly, it was held in a church, the St Mildred's Church in Tenterden, which is the big one lying just off the high street. And it was absolutely packed. There was nearly 300 people there. So there was an air of anticipation from the off. Four of the five candidates made it. There was John Howson from the Lib Dems, Kitty Lamb from the Conservatives, Lenny Rawls for Labour, and Kit Walder for the Green Party, the guy from the from Form UK, Daniel Kirsten, couldn't make it. He's got a bad leg.
And what topics came under discussion?
Well, as you might expect, usuals, Brexit, bonuses to sewage company bosses, affordable housing, immigration and the NHS. All the candidates trotted out the party line, as one you would expect, but there was no debate as such, just pre-prepared questions with candidates giving their views for a set time on each.
So what sort of things were you looking out for?
Well, there's very little anything to report from these things unless there's a punch-up. But just I wanted to try and ascertain how the Tory candidate was received and how the Labour candidate was received. And unfortunately, since the Reform UK guy couldn't make it, we couldn't work out what his reception would have been. I mean, all the candidates spoke very well. They presented their arguments in a very cogent way. I mean, the audience wasn't allowed to ask questions from the floor and make observations, so we didn't have any heckling as such. So, on balance, I think Mr. Rawls probably shaded it, although others might disagree. You could kind of sense there was a bit of a warmth towards him and the audience was more accommodating. That's just my feeling. Most people, including pollsters like Martin Baxter, who we'll be speaking to in a little while, see this one as one of the Tories' easier constituencies, and there's very little to think that that is not true. If Reform's Daniel Kirsten picks up a lot of votes and the left of centre vote, that's Mr. Howson and Mrs. Waldo for the Lib Dems and the Greens coalesce behind Labour, there might, just might, be a shock there. You know, unlikely, but you never know. Now we turn to Paul Francis, the KM Group political editor. What's caught your attention this week as we head towards the finish line?
No surprise that these final few days are going to be a fairly frantic period of activity for all the parties. And it's quite good to hear about these hustings meetings because, you know, we scoff at them, but they're showing democracy in open debate, so that's a good thing. Although I agree with you, the place you're least likely to see a punch-up in church is in Tenterden. So, yeah, and I think the overriding conclusion for me about the campaign is that Rishi Sunak gambled, and that gamble has failed. He thought that he could surprise everyone with a snap poll, gain some ground, put the Reform UK lot into a quandary about whether to stand and contest the election properly. But as we've seen, as the weeks have passed, it's been a long 5 or 6 weeks. As all the bad luck has come his way. You know, from the very moment that he stood outside Downing Street without an umbrella and got a soaking, to the D-Day commemorations fiasco, and now this odd situation with this. Allegations of gambling and betting on the election results from some people inside his own team. When you feel sort of making up a disastrous electoral campaign, you'd have a good source of material from this one.
Especially sort of in 2 weeks prior to an election was really kind of blown up. And then he hasn't done himself any favours by sort of saying, you know, his only sort of experience of deprivation has been to be without Sky television.
Yes. As I say, it has been one of the oddest election campaigns that I've covered, I have to say.
Yeah, it's been one of the oddest ones. And I was just saying to the guys beforehand that at the end of the day, one of the reasons why it's been so interesting is because it's actually been interesting. Because normally general election campaigns, especially on a local level, don't really throw up very much, especially in a county like Kent where you've got so many, you know, MPs of one stripe.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think anything he's announced has moved the dial one iota in terms of voter support. And some of these important issues, like small boats crossing, what they're going to do about that, migration, compromise over the Kent countryside, haven't really had as much of an airing as they ought to have done.
Okay, thanks, Paul. We'll speak to you a bit later on. Polling day is nearly upon us. We've had a lot of time to mull over our thoughts. So, chaps, it's time to put your reputations on the line and make a prediction. I'll go around the room and ask you for your Kent predictions and also which constituencies you think are worth watching out for. Dan, what do you reckon?
So, in Kent, I reckon, maybe it's a bit of a cop-out, but I reckon electoral calculus probably have it on the money. I think their prediction seems reasonable, which, as far as I know at the moment, is 14 seats to Labour, one to the Liberal Democrats, and three to the Conservatives. I think that's pretty much on the money. I think either way, pretty much all of East Kent is going to go Labour. It would amaze me if they didn't. I mean, there's quite a few constituencies, like Dover, for example, where it would be more of an upset if the Labour Party lost it now, given they've been working it for so long. But my two main constituencies to look out for, other than, of course, Dover, because I know it quite well, are Folkestone Hive and Herne Bay and Sandwich. So maybe Herne Bay and Sandwich is fresh in mind, because I was at Hustings there earlier this week, but as it stands at the moment, it's expected to just about go Labour. There was a lot of there seems to be a lot of support for the Green candidate when I was at the Hustings, but like I say, that's not broadly representative. I think it's interesting because it'll unseat one of the longest serving MPs in the country. Roger Gale was elected in the 1983 election for North Thanet, and he's re-standing for that seat. He's, I think, probably the third or fourth longest serving in the entire country, which is quite something, and he's deputy speaker.
Yeah, it's got to be quite a scalp. So what about Folkestone Hive? That's a bit tighter, that one, isn't it?
Yeah, well, so Folkestone Hive, the vibe I get is I don't think the Labour Party expected to win it. I can't remember if it was on their list of target seats or not. Yeah. But I think their candidate there, Tony Vaughan, and their campaign, I think they're now pretty convinced they're going to get it. Damien Collins, the local MP, at least as far as I can tell, doesn't have a brilliant reputation. But I find Folkestone Hive particularly interesting because I think, as well as Herne Bay and Sandwich, it points to a tension which is going to be quite real for the Labour, for the incoming Labour government, because their candidate there, Tony Vaughan, he's a lawyer, very much on the left, was a Remainer, but Folkestone Hive is quite a Brexit voting seat, probably quite socially conservative under a lot of sort of opinion polling, and I think that'll be a real tension under the Labour government. You're going to have a lot of MPs who are, you know, in their opinions, well, they personally believe pretty far away from the public, and they'll be representing constituencies which have generally voted against that kind of thing, but have gone with the anti-Tory tide. So I think those two will be one to watch both on voting night and afterwards.
Okay. Paul, what do you reckon the final tally will be in Kent? And you're going to have a look, just talk about Tunbridge Wells briefly.
Yes. Well, I said it would be 9 seats apiece for the Tories at night and Labour divvying up the 18 constituencies.
Do you reckon 9 will go to the Tories, yeah?
Yeah, 9. I do, yeah. I'm going to stick my head out here. Neck out and put it on the line. Not literally, of course. But yeah, I think some of these polls may overestimate the vote going Labour's way. It seems to be a bit of a drag, no momentum behind Labour's campaign just at the moment. But I think they are facing a stiffer challenge than perhaps they thought. As to my seat to watch, I'm going for Tunbridge Wells, and that's because this could be where the Liberal Democrats bring a shock result and finally make a parliamentary breakthrough in Kent, which they've not had for several decades now. Mm. Now, it's been quite interesting. There's a lot of attention paid on Tunbridge Wells in the early stages of the campaign, and we haven't seen any return visits by Ed Davey, the leader, for example. Yeah, the party is short on VIP, you know, big hitters to some extent. But I think the Liberal Democrat candidate seems relatively optimistic, but it could be a tight one, could go to a recount. You know, that I think we might see some recounts on election night.
Interesting. Rob, what do you reckon your predictions will be?
Well, I mean, not to sound like I'm just following what Paul said, I am also a little bit sceptical of sort of the scale of the Labour victory nationally. I think there are a lot of constituencies which will be very, very tight. And I think a lot of the Kent seats will fall on the more to the Conservative side will stick with, to use the phrase, the devil they know rather than the devil they don't. So I'm sitting around possibly 2 seats for the Lib Dems, 7 seats for Labour, and the rest all for Tories, just because I think the rate of movement would be too much at this point. I mean, I guess you could say, if not now, when?
But where would the Lib Dems get theirs apart from Thomas Wolfe?
Possibly, I would say,
Mr. the Morning.
Yeah, I think that's possibly the closest one. But you know, as you say, this is all just predictions off of.
So you're going for of the 18, the majority will be Conservative, and the rest will be split. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
And then my seat, which I think will be quite interesting to watch, over the three Medway seats, I think it's going to be Chatham and Aylesford, purely because it's one of these seats which are sort of on a knife edge. I mean, speaking to the candidates, they are really sort of, they're not being overly confident. They're saying we've got to get there out every single day because it's just so close. I mean, to be within a percentage point, I think it could be. I mean, you've got, obviously, Tracy Crouch was the MP who has now stepped down and has been replaced with Nathan Gamester. So you haven't got that sort of
continuity.
Exactly. Yeah.
And reputation as well.
Absolutely. And so I think that's going to be, you know, I have no idea which way that could go. It could absolutely go either.
Mm. Well, it was funny, actually, when Dame Tracy was with us a few months ago, she was very confident that the Tories would actually retain that without the usual sort of platitudinous stuff that they come up with. She seemed to have very good reasons why she thought they would. Well, personally, I tend to err more towards what Dan's saying. I don't think that the number of Labour seats will be quite as high as 14. I think that there'll be a couple which could be sort of, as you call them, absolutely knife edge close. And so I would say that Labour are going to do very, very well, but I don't think they'll do quite as well as the polls have been suggesting. As for ones to watch, Mitchell and Morling could be interesting for the reasons you've just outlined. I think Lib Dems will do better in the county perhaps than people might think. If they're going to win, they're going to win at Tunbridge Wells, and if they've got a chance, they've probably got a chance at Mitchell and Morling. And Weald of Kent will only be interesting if the reform vote goes out and the left of centre vote coalesces behind the Labour Party candidate. It could be a shock. It might be a shock. I don't think it, but it might be one of the ones we want to have a look at.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
We're into the final furlong of the race to number 10 Downing Street. One of the big features of this campaign has been the presence of polls, sophisticated MRP mega polls, no less, which all seem, to one degree or another, spell doom for the Conservatives. Joining us today is Martin Baxter, founder and CEO of Pollsters Electoral Calculus. Welcome, Martin.
Hello, Simon.
How are you?
Ah, oh, super. Thanks. How are you?
Yeah, not so bad. Thank you. You're very welcome. We're entering the final few days of the general election campaign. Are you going to be issuing an eve of election poll?
Well, we'll certainly be updating the website as we go, maybe another two or three times.
Really?
As we get more polling evidence in, we will try always to keep up with public opinion. Public opinion has been changing a bit. In the last couple of weeks, we've seen a bit of a split for the smaller parties, for the Lib Dems, and particularly for Reform under Nigel Farage. So both the major parties are suffering a little bit. But obviously, as you said at the beginning, Labour is still looking in a very strong position at the moment.
Okay. I mean, in Kent, as it stood, the Tories had 16 seats in 2019 with one Labour. I think the most extraordinary turnaround, it appears, according to the polls. You're predicting that 14 would go to Labour, 3 to the Conservatives, and a single Liberal Democrat gain on one. I mean, do you stand by these numbers?
We do until we update them, but there are two things to say, I suppose. The general trend that things look very good for Labour is well established, and yes, we absolutely stand by that. The exact number of seats the Conservatives get is actually a little bit uncertain. That we've got estimates going down as far as 40 or as high as 200. So we think ourselves that it's maybe between about 50 and 100 seats. Other pollsters have it a bit higher, between 100 and 150 seats. But, you know, either way, those are relatively small differences in the sort of big scheme of things, which is that it looks like it's going to be a very bad election for the Conservative Party.
I wanted to ask you something, Martin, about kind of the political influence of polling. Some countries, I think particularly of France, actually ban polling for a certain period during the election campaign. And some people argue that the function of polling is just as much opinion forming as it is opinion reporting. Do you think polling skews voting behaviour? And do you think maybe there's a case for, you know, more regulation around the use of them during election time?
I don't think there's much evidence that it skews our behaviour. I mean, we saw the main change in the polls over the campaign was the growth of Reform with Nigel Farage, which was, I think, driven by the events that the Reform Party did, and also a natural growth in the Liberal Democrats, which tends to happen as people approach polling day. And if I could sort of say so, people remember about the Liberal Democrats more, and they get more focus and they get more votes. So I don't think there's particular evidence that the polls themselves are changing public opinion. The polls are measuring public opinion, and that's a different thing.
We've seen these polls that predict, you know, these huge majorities for Labour. But there is sort of a school of thought that there are around sort of 100 seats that are really sort of a knife edge, very, very close. I mean, too close to call, actually, when the election comes. And that could really influence the outcome of the election. That's, you know, could cut down that majority significantly. I mean, what do you think about that? Do you buy that as a possibility?
Well, yes, there is. There's certainly, you're right, that there's a lot of seats on the edge that could go either way. And in the office, one of our team was explaining to me the concept of expected goals in football, where if you've got a shot at goal, it's neither in or out, it's maybe half a goal. And there's a similar concept of expected seats, that where a seat is quite close, you could say that it's one seat for Labour, but it's maybe another point of view is to say, well, it's maybe half a seat for Conservatives and half a seat for Labour. And we were adding up expected seats in the office. And we did find that the Conservatives were doing a bit better on expected seats. They were getting around 100 or so. So it could make a difference, and that reflects all these, you know, marginal seats that could go either way. So yes, the Conservatives could gain, you know, 20 or 40 seats more if some of the marginals just break the right way for them. But that's not, say, going to be enough to bring Rishi Sunak back into Downing Street, but it could change the number of seats the Conservatives win.
We spoke recently about some of the Kent seats, and included in that was the new Herne Bay and Sandwichwell, which seems to be quite interesting because you were saying it started off, or previously in 2019, had a very different kind of demographic to what it has now, according to your polls. What is that attributed to?
Well, so I'm just looking at Herne Bay and Sandwich now. So obviously back in 2019, Herne Bay and Sandwich was a very strong Conservative seat. Conservatives getting about two-thirds of the vote. And now a lot of that vote has disappeared on the RAR figures. And Conservative are now neck and neck with Labour with about 40% each. And Reform has taken some, and the other party's been squeezed a bit. So the story of Herne Bay is very much the story that we're seeing across the south of England, that formerly very strong Conservative areas where, you know, if you just walk down the high street, you would think to yourself, this is probably going to vote Conservative, this area. And they are not anymore. They are Conservative voters are going in a number of directions. They're going to Reform. Maybe they're staying at home. Some of them are switching to Labour and the Lib Dems. But it's letting Labour have a solid chance of winning many seats that previously would have been almost inconceivable for Labour to be winning there. So it is, very strange times indeed, this election. And Herne Bay is very much an exemplar of that.
Okay. Can we just move on to Reform UK? A lot's happened since Nigel Farage decided that he wanted to change his mind and come back as and stand for Parliament and also to be the leader. But in recent days, he made some comments, which were widely reported, about the West provoking Putin into aggression towards Ukraine. Do you think that's going to hurt Reform UK in the polls, or does it actually play into the sort of dog whistle politics of what might appeal to potential Reform UK voters?
Well, it's hard to say directly. We did a poll recently on attitudes to defence issues, including Ukraine. And there's a large amount of support for Ukraine in the British public. So taking the side of the Russians is not obviously a vote winner. On the other hand, Nigel Farage, for what some people might think of him, is quite a clever and skillful politician. So He wouldn't have said this by accident. So it's not clear to me exactly what he's trying to achieve, because it's not a surefire vote winner to be against Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And so that might hurt reform, but the recent polls that we're getting in just now don't seem to show reform down very much. But
well, this story broke sort of, I think it was right about last weekend-ish, or the back end of last week. So it's had some time to filter through, but you're not seeing it in the most recent polling then?
Let's just have a look now. So there's a lot of polls, and there's a variety of leads for the Conservatives over reform. So the Conservatives are still mostly ahead on average. There's the occasional poll that has reform ahead, but that is still a minority of polls. So the Conservatives are still ahead of reform, but they're not ahead of reform by a huge amount. So on our average, they're only ahead by about 2%, 2 or 3% or so. So if reform lose support due to Nigel Farage's comments about Putin, then that will be good news for the Conservatives.
Okay.
I just want to ask you a small supplementary question on that. Do you have any information on how much foreign policy issues, for example, Ukraine or sort of in a different way, Gaza, actually affect people's vote behaviour?
We did do a bit of a survey on this back in earlier in the year before we knew there was an election. I'm afraid foreign and defence policy, although it's an important issue and important to many people, it's not one of the top issues for most people. Most people's issues tend to be focused on things like the economy, the NHS, housing, and those sorts of everyday issues. So defence tends not to be one of the most salient issues, but it's clearly an important one.
I mean, something that has obviously been rumbling on very recently is this whole gambling scandal, which has been going on with quite a few Tories allegedly being caught using inside information to put bets on the day to the general election. I mean, how do you think has that been reflected in the polling? Does that play a role?
It's certainly not good for the Conservatives. I bet the Conservatives are wishing this whole story had not happened. The Labour lead is still fairly stable at around 20%, and it has been like that for a long time now. So it's not made a sort of catastrophic difference, but it presumably cannot help for this story to be in the press day after day for the Conservatives, because, as you say, it does bring back all bad memories about Tory sleaves for them.
Like you've been saying, a lot of polls say different things, but the broad consensus seems to be that most of the polls are predicting, borderline extinction event for the Conservatives. The electoral calculus, the sort of middle prediction, I think, at the moment is 76 seats. But polls have been wrong in the past. What's happened to polling in the past few years to make it more accurate?
You're absolutely right that polls have been wrong. That I remember in 1992, the polls predicted Neil Kinnock and the Labour Party would win the election against John Major, and that did not happen. So they were wrong by about 9% on the lead. So obviously pollsters learn from our experience and try their best every year to get it right, but there are no guarantees and it could be wrong again. This year we do have the MRP polls as well as the traditional polls, and testing suggests that the MRP polls are as accurate or sometimes more accurate than the traditional polls. Back in 2017, the MRP polls were more accurate in predicting that election. So the MRP polls definitely help, but there's no guarantee. All the pollsters could be looking very silly come Friday morning next week, but we will have to wait and see. On the other hand, the pollsters would have to look incredibly stupid for Labour not to win. You may quote me on that next week. We'll see.
I might bring you on next Friday morning. Yeah.
One other small thing I wanted to ask. I remember a lot of people saying at the start of the election campaign, that the polls will narrow as we get closer to polling day, and maybe your data in a couple of days will say that. But it doesn't seem to have happened that much. Why is that?
Well, I think the Conservatives were hoping very much that they could persuade two groups of former Conservatives to come back to them. And those were the people who planned not to vote because they did not like the Conservatives anymore, but they did not like anybody else. And the people who went to reform. They were trying to get back both the stay-at-homes and the reform voters. The appearance of Nigel Farage has meant the sort of defection or has pushed out the other way. More Conservatives have gone to reform rather than come back. We are not seeing any evidence in our numbers that the Conservative voters who are planning to stay at home have changed their mind to a great extent. So the Conservative hope that they could get these voters back has not so far come to pass. There's still a week to go, but the clock is beginning to run out on that idea. Why that is, I suppose, is a big question for the political scientists, but I can give you some idea that we did a little poll a couple of weeks ago where we spoke to only people who had voted Conservative in 2019, but were planning not to vote Conservative this time. And we asked them to explain in their own reasons, in their own words, what their reasons were for changing. And the main reasons were just a failure to deliver in general, also a failure on immigration and incompetence, and a whole list of general points about being divided and bad economic management. And it's issues which are, can't really be sorted in the even a six-week election campaign. There's essentially a big perception of Conservative failure amongst many voters, and that perception will not fade quickly or easily. And I think that is the wall that the Rishi Sunak and the Conservatives have run into.
Do you have a view about how the approval ratings for Rishi and Starmer are playing out? And is there a gap which is bridgeable for Rishi Sunak or not?
I've not got those numbers in front of me. I mean, generally, at the moment, when you ask any question about the Conservatives or Rishi Sunak, you get negative answers from the public. And if you ask a question about Keir Starmer and the Labour Party, you get more positive answers. And it almost irrespective of what the question is. And that goes back, I think, into the deeper attitudes that people just are tired of the Conservatives. They think it's time for a change, and that they have failed to deliver. They've not used their 80-seat majority for the benefit of the country. And they are really, many people are sick of hearing from them.
Okay. Come 10 p.m., we'll be awaiting the exit polls, as most journalists do, which are a fairly reliable way of predicting the election result. Just for the benefit of the listeners, can you just explain how these work in practice? How do you actually make an exit poll?
Yes, well, it's a big operation. So we don't take part in it, but there's a team of academics and political scientists and statisticians, and they set up groups at, I think, over 100 places around the country, and they interview people as they come out of the polling station having voted. And I think they get them to just fill in a duplicate ballot, pop it in a bucket or something. And so they get people just to replay the vote they've just cast. And it gets rid of a lot of problems that you have with regular polling, where you're never quite sure whether people are going to vote or not because they've just come out of a polling station. You pretty much know they voted. So you're seeing actual voters. You're getting them to repeat the vote they've cast. And then the exit poll people do some calculations to infer what the result is for the country as a whole. And as you say, it has been very accurate the last few elections. It gets the occasional thing a little bit off, but on the whole, very accurate. And so it's usually a pretty good guide for what's happening. This year will be, I think, particularly interesting because there's so much movement. So many Conservative voters have gone to Reform or staying at home or going to Labour or the Lib Dems. Has been such a big movement in politics. I'm sure it will.
Do you think that will make it likely to be inaccurate, or more likely to be inaccurate? That's the question.
I don't think it's never a good idea to bet against the exit poll.
Yeah,
I'll say that much. But it maybe creates a little bit more uncertainty than they usually have to cope with. So I'm hoping they cope well with it. But it's certainly, we're seeing it on the pre-poll side that, say, the Conservative number of seats is a tricky quantity to get down exactly. That reasonable people can have different opinions on that. And the exit poll, they have a little bit of extra uncertainty there as well.
Okay, you've got over 100 of these sort of places set up. What sort of sample would they be taking at each of those, in each of those constituencies?
I'm not an expert, but I think they're there for quite a lot of the day.
Yeah.
So they're trying to
get
a pretty good sample.
Yeah. Okay. And would they just have one polling station, or would they have them scattered all over the place?
So they have over 100 sites around the UK. I think they'd have one site.
No, how many within each constituency would they try to get polling stations in?
No. They have 100 sites across the country. They don't have 100 seats they're looking at. So they would have one polling place in this seat and then another polling place in that seat, I think is how it goes.
Yeah, and that's just to get the sort of the overall view. Yeah, okay.
Yes, and part of their methodology strength as they see it, is that they use pretty much the same sites this year that they used in 2019. So they get a comparison. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the magic source that they get to see a change from one year to the next in the same place with, you know, very much similar demographics.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there, just finally, is there anywhere in Kent where we can expect a shock result if you were going to stick your neck out?
Oh, wow. I mean, this election, the shock results could be anywhere, and Kent could certainly have some. So essentially, all the places where we and maybe other MRP predictors think that there's going to be Labour gains, any Labour gains in Kent are going to be quite interesting. Let me just have a quick look at the map to see where in particular. I mean, the whole south coast of Kent, so Bexhill and Battle, Hastings and Rye, Folkestone and Hythe, Ashford, Dover and Deal, and even Thanet East, those are all seats that Labour could gain. And so those are ones to watch. I suppose Dover is a particularly interesting one because the outgoing Conservative MP, Natalie Elphick, perceives being on the right of the party, but nonetheless switched to Labour, although she's not a candidate this time. The Conservatives won the seat with over half the vote in 2019, but on our numbers, it could be that the Labour win this seat with, you know, the centre-right vote split between Conservatives and Reform. So if I had to pick one, I'd pick Dover. Mm. To see whether the red flags are going to be flying over the White Cliffs.
Okay, Martin. Listen, Martin Baxter of Electoral Calculus, thank you very much indeed for your time today, and I hope we can catch up with you very soon.
That's great. Thanks, Simon.
Okay, folks, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Rob, Dan, Paul, and to our special guest, Martin Baxter of Electoral Calculus. You can keep abreast of the results coming in from Kent with live coverage on KMTV throughout the night on July the 4th and into the morning of the 5th. We will have a special pod recorded on the day after the election as we digest what the results mean for Kent. So please join us then. See you later.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.